So I've been thinking about tariffs recently. No reason why, just interested. And while reading, I came across a series of interesting papers by economists Michael Clemens and Jeffrey Williamson, and they explore what looks like an economic paradox. Up until World War I, the countries of Latin America were the most protectionist in the world, with some of its highest tariff rates. East Asia, on the other hand, for reasons we will discuss later, had tariffs just a fraction as high. Yet during these decades, the Latin American countries grew faster than the Asian ones. Before World War I, one might argue that if you wanted faster economic growth, you needed higher tariffs. Then things changed. In this video, high tariffs in Latin America, low tariffs in Asia. One works, the other doesn't, right? No. Time, context, and composition matter. Let me set the stage by first mentioning a few things. I want to make clear that while I will refer to Asia and Latin America as single regions, they are most definitely not. The paper considers Latin America to be Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, Mexico, Peru, and Uruguay. And Asia is defined in the paper as Burma, Ceylon, China, Egypt, not sure why, India, Indonesia, Japan, the Philippines, Thailand, and Turkey. This paper groups a very large swath of countries into two generalized regions. Each country has their own political, economic, and cultural differences. When appropriate, I might highlight those differences and get specific, but to keep ourselves from getting too bogged down in the details, we need to stay general, because this is just going to be one of those videos. And since a lot of this historical data is spotty and hard to compare across countries, Clemens and Williamson noted that they calculated tariff rates as total revenue from import duties divided by the value of imports in that year. Okay, with such caveats in mind, let us begin. In the 1820s, Latin America fights a series of wars to win their political independence from Spain and Portugal. These wars saw the creation of the countries of Brazil, Gran Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Central America, and Mexico. Prior to independence, the Latin American colonies were run as part of a mercantilist network favoring Europe. Their economies primarily depended on the export of raw goods like silver, sugar, and coffee. Imports had to be carried by Spanish or Portuguese-owned ships and stop at their ports. These import restrictions protected the colonies from foreign competition, particularly in the nascent manufacturing sector. It also meant that Spain and Portugal didn't need to raise tariffs. These empires eventually fell apart, thanks in part to Napoleon. In the case of Portugal, Napoleon's threat against countries trading with Britain led to France invading Portugal. Their king flees to Brazil for over a decade. That king is soon called back, leaving his son Pedro I in charge. Pedro declares Brazil an independent empire. So Brazil's independence from Portugal was relatively gradual. Spain's was not. After invading Portugal, Napoleon takes advantage of the country's instability. Napoleon forces King Charles IV to abdicate and puts his own brother on the throne. This act annihilated the country's imperial credibility. The colonies were not sure who to obey. The crown managed to put down a few of the first independent movements, but the elites had lost their faith in their king's ability to maintain order and protect their interests. Fernando VII returned to power as King of Spain and tried to reestablish an absolutist monarchy after a time of liberalism and self-rule. This failed, and everything went to hell. Vibes were immaculate. The wars shattered their country's abilities to collect revenues in a traditional manner. They had already borrowed heavily to raise and maintain their armies for the wars, and military conflict between the newly established countries continued on as neighbors clashed over borders. One of the major promises of independence was to lift heavy, exploitative tax burdens imposed by Europe to fight its own wars back home. Such taxes were levied on working populations like the farmers or miners. Indigenous had a head tax, which they especially hated paying. It would be hypocritical for the new governments to resume those taxes. And even if leaders were ideologically open to keeping such taxes, they lacked the infrastructure and bureaucracy to collect them anyway. The wars left over 1 million dead and destroyed a lot of infrastructure. The colonies were all left in various states of political, social, and economic instability. Taxing incoming shipments at a central port was the easiest way to raise revenue. So in the early days after independence, government leaders turned to heavy tariffs of 30 to 40% to fund their activities. Between 1820 and 1890, tariffs produced 57.8% of government revenue for 11 Latin American republics. Take Mexico. After winning its independence from Spain in 1821, the newly founded Mexican state imposed its first tariff law, raising tariffs on textile imports to 25%. 60% of total imports during this first decade were textiles purchased by upper-class individuals who could afford such items. Yes, tariffs protected the country's nascent manufacturing sectors, like Mexico's artisanal cotton industry, but industrial development was not the intention. The intention was to make money. In Mexico's case, these tariffs did not sufficiently protect from British imports. In 1828, major riots in the city of Puebla, with participation by members of the Mexican cotton industry, helped put a military officer named Vicente Guerrero into the presidency. Guerrero initially promised a ban on all cotton imports in 1829, but then delayed it for 6 months and later finally rescinded it due to concerns about revenue impact. Half of Mexican governmental revenues in the 1820s came from tariffs. Another example is Peru, after its military loss to Chile in the War of the Pacific in the 1880s. The economy was already suffering from the guano industry's collapse. To pay for the war, the Peruvian government raised tariffs and relied upon them for the majority of revenue in the late 1800s. Now we move on to Asia. By 1885, Latin America had tariff rates 5 times higher than those in Asia. Considering that these are two economically undeveloped regions, why didn't the Asian countries adopt high tariffs too? First and foremost, many of these Asian nations were colonized or semi-colonized in the 1800s and early 1900s, meaning they had little control over their own tariffs. India, of course, was then part of the British Empire, so they followed the empire's general free trade-oriented attitude and its low tariff rates. The same with Burma, Ceylon, and Indonesia, then part of the Dutch Empire. Even for those Asian countries that have not been colonized, there were unequal treaties made possible by gunboat diplomacy. China, after losing the Opium Wars, was bound by the unequal treaties of Nanking and Tientsin until 1929. These set a standard tariff rate of about 5% ad valorem. For centuries, Japan practiced something akin to autarky. But Matthew Perry's gunboats opened up the country's markets, leading to its own set of unequal treaties limiting tariffs to a range of 3.75% to 5%. Though they regained some autonomy in 1899, a few items remained subject to low duties until 1911. Thailand, which back then was called Siam, avoided colonization, but adopted low tariffs of about 3% on their own per the Bohring Treaty of 1855 with Britain. This remained the case until 1890, when the king at the time began ambitiously reforming the nation. Perhaps the Asian country that stuck out the most were the Philippines, which had an unusually high tariff rate of 21% from 1900 to 1913. But in some ways, it illustrates the principle. The higher tariff was because the country transitioned from Spanish to United States control in 1899, and the United States itself was then quite protectionist. Philippines' tariff rates were just 2 points below that of the United States. Clemens and Williamson do make it clear that there seem to be other factors at play, particularly to explain the variance between countries. Asia's populations were far larger than Latin America's. Larger populations offer larger internal markets that can more accommodate both domestic producers and imports, dampening the demand for tariffs. Latin America's smaller populations, which, by the way, were smaller thanks to historic plagues, were also more urbanized. Urbanized populations have historically been more apt to organize and agitate for trade protection than rural ones. Another thing that lowers the demand for trade protections are natural barriers to trade, like an undeveloped transportation network. In the 1800s, Asian countries had little train access inland, making it difficult for goods to reach the coast and larger markets abroad. On the other hand, Latin American regions on the Atlantic coast facing Europe, Brazil, Cuba, Uruguay, and such, had good access to foreign markets. And before 1914, their railroad networks had more track laid down, thanks to large investments made to transport mined export goods. And finally, Clemens and Williamson say that if a country's trading partners have high tariffs, that country will also tend to adopt higher tariffs themselves. Same for lower tariffs. Asia's top trading partners prior to the World Wars were the industrialized, more free trade-oriented countries, mostly Britain. Latin America, on the other hand, did a lot of trade with the United States, which at the time was quite protectionist. So this high tariff differential between Asia and Latin America, what did it do to economic growth? During this time, economic growth in Latin America continued at a steady pace via the existing system of natural resource exports. Leaving the Spanish Empire freed these countries from its onerous taxes and let them trade directly with Europe and North America. The scholar Leandro Prado de la Escosura estimated that between 1820 and 1870, Latin America's income per capita grew about 0.5% each year. This is about the global average. It lagged Western Europe and United States, yes, but those countries were at different stages of development. America's per capita income in the 1820s was nearly twice that of the Latin countries. So, de la Escosura argues for restricting comparisons to just countries with similar starting income rates, for example, China, India, Japan, and what records we have in Africa. This comparison is much more forgiving, and it shows that during this time, Latin America grew faster than those other countries, fast enough to make up ground against the United States, whereas China and India sank. Clemens and Williamson also find that prior to World War I, Latin America's economic growth rates, with their five times higher tariff rates, far outpaced that of the countries of East Asia. And that is why they say that higher tariffs were correlated with higher growth prior to World War II. Correlation is not causation, I want to make absolutely clear. There's a whole lot of difference between Latin America and Asia, and invite the viewers to yell at each other in the comments about those differences, but this is interesting. The tariff gap between Latin America and Asia largely closes after World War I. During this time, various Asian countries like China, India, Ceylon, and Burma caught the protectionist bug. Only the Philippines and Japan did not so substantially raise their tariff rates. We can attribute this to multiple factors. Money had to be raised to fight the war and other ongoing conflicts in the area. The Great Depression unleashed excess capacity around the world, leading to a global rise in tariffs like the Smoot-Hawley Act. So, by the end of the 1930s, tariff rates in Asia were about as high as those in the Latin American countries, and this remained the case through the war, with what seems to be economic consequences down the line. The Japan case is interesting. Their domestic industries faced import competition from overseas, like the Germans and dyes, but they realized they could not raise tariffs without retaliation. So they decided to try non-tariff protections like import restrictions, subsidies, and urging their companies to organize into cartels and conglomerates. Then they started manipulating the currency. Every country used to link their currency to gold. In 1929, Japan tried to return to the gold standard after leaving it during the war, but the global depression and an overvalued currency eventually caused them to drop gold again. The currency crashed 40%. Real wages crashed 30% too. This double whammy, combined with new automation tools, enabled a Japanese export boom that returned the economy to growth. Japanese textiles flooded into traditionally British-dominated markets like China, India, Hong Kong, and Southeast Asia. At the same time, the Japanese began focusing on specific industries like cars and steel, urging them to combine to hit scale. I mentioned the car policies in a prior video about Nissan, and the steel policies in a prior video about Nippon, iron, and steel. For their part, Britain, urged on by business elites in its various dominions, decided to respond to Japanese competition in 1932 with the Ottawa Conference, raising trade barriers outside of the empire while allowing the dominions increased tariff autonomy. India, for their part, raised their tariff rate some four times over, from 5.5% in 1920 to 27.5% in 1939. Other British colonies in Asia, Burma and Ceylon, had tariff raises too, though nowhere as dramatic. With traditional markets closed, the Japanese turned to exporting into its colonies of Korea and Taiwan, as well as its semi-colonies of Manchuria, the least province of Guangdong via Russia, and others prior to war with China. And as I mentioned, higher tariffs were correlated with higher economic growth, and this somewhat remained the case all the way through the Second World War. The strange thing is that after World War II, this correlation broke, and even reversed itself. The fastest growing countries were those industrializing states that lowered their tariffs and trade barriers. This is a strange paradox, and in another paper co-authored with Christopher Blattman, Clemens and Williamson leave a few thoughts as to why this was the case. They mention how certain core industrial countries like France, UK, the United States, and Germany had the big domestic markets, infrastructure, capital, and skilled labor necessary for future industrialization. For them, tariffs were not just about revenues for government. These trade restrictions were to protect the industrial base until it was ready to break out when the nature of the global economy changed in their favor. I don't presume to be the authority on industrial protections and tariffs. Lots of these writings are 20 plus years old, and we are all learning here in real time. This is what I am learning so far. The idea seems to be that tariffs can exist for different reasons and must be used in the right way. They and other forms of import substitution policies seem to work best when they are used to nurture the industrial base. Like how China nurtured its EV industry during its early days in the 2010s. That particular example used both non-tariff and tariff trade restrictions to build that industry. Per the work of Albert Hirschman, a key part of successful import substitution seems to be that the tariffs must be targeted and temporary. Targeted to core industries that are quote-unquote demanding in some way, like how building a successful sports car or high-performance CPU is so demanding that it instills, naturally, discipline and productivity. Successes in such core industries can flow through into other sectors, like how China's lithium-ion ecosystem flowed into EVs, and how Intel CPUs fueled the PC boom. And protections must be temporary. China did this too. At some point, the tariffs or whatever trade restrictions must be lifted and foreign competition brought back in. Otherwise, you get Latin America post-1950, which has largely been defined by economic stagnancy. TLDR, like any tool, tariffs can be good or bad. Use them right. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.